This is Digital Story Podcast number 545, August 16th, 2016. Today's theme is conservation photography. I'm Derek Story. Most of us probably think that we're ethical photographers. But what does that really mean? Is it a common sense thing? Or are there real guidelines to help us act responsibly when photographing landscapes, wildlife, and indigenous cultures? I explore this topic today with Alexandra Garcia, Executive Director of the International League of Conservation Photographers. And I think you're really going to enjoy and learn from what she has to say. I met Alexandra Garcia at the Mindshift Gear headquarters in Santa Rosa, California. She was working there with them on a project and agreed to take time out with me to talk about conservation photography. You get to listen in thanks to Mindshift Gear, who is sponsoring this portion of the podcast as part of their goal to help outdoor photographers engage with nature and to support the conservation of our environment. Now, I went into this conversation thinking that I knew a lot about conservation photography, ethics, and all those related sort of things, only to discover that I had a lot more to learn. And I think that's why I'm so excited about bringing this show to you today, because I think you may experience some of that also. What Alexandra has to share in terms of, you know, how to act while we're out in the field, what's going on behind the scenes, how you can learn more, things to keep in mind while you're photographing indigenous cultures, wildlife, and the great American outdoors, it's really fascinating. It's really fascinating. And the cool thing about it is, not only do we get to learn from her today, but we have resources to point you to so that you can continue this exploration. And I think it's particularly important to keep this in mind and maybe do a little research before you take your next big trip to anywhere beautiful, anywhere where there's wildlife, or there are people who you may want to photograph. So let's sit back, let's learn from Alexandra, and then I'll be back with the rest of the show after we have our chat. Well, welcome aboard. I'm so happy to be here visiting with you. We haven't met before.
No, we have not.
No, we have not. But you have told me that I can call you Alex.
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. So, it ends up always being cut down anyway.
Yeah. So okay. Great. So I really want to have this conversation with you for a couple reasons. One is, this is an area that I'm really curious about. And just before we get into you educating me about this, one of the reasons why I like conservation and photography so much is because of the history. I mean, photography has this rich history in conservation. Some of the photographers we know the most about, they started out as conservation photographers, right?
Absolutely. Ansel Adams comes to mind.
Ansel Adams does come to mind, doesn't he? Yeah. And you know how much they've had to do with helping, you know, preserve big chunks of, you know, here in the U.S. anyway, big chunks of countryside. So this is really cool that this tradition is continuing. So tell me a little bit about, you know, the International League of Conservation Photographers.
Sure. So ILCP was founded in 2005 at the 8th World Wilderness Conference in Anchorage, Alaska. It was the collective effort of about 40 founding fellows. We now call them the founding fellows, who really wanted to have an organization that would further their personal ideas of taking photography beyond just the pretty pictures to having an organization that supported what they were each doing individually in terms of conservation photography. There wasn't really anything that existed before that that sort of brought everybody together under an umbrella. As a nonprofit organization, we serve a dual purpose. One, we are this collective of photographers, of professional nature, wildlife, and cultural photographers who are driven by a communal mission of saving the planet. And also, we take those skills and the assets that come with that and work with conservation groups to help them acquire imagery either through expeditions or through image licensing that will help them further their own campaigns and their missions of protecting places, people, animals.
So this is really about talented people, photographers, who have a passion for conservation, wanting to bring the two together.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so, I think that's great because, you know, one of the things that I think makes for good photography is something that you're really, you know, serious about, something that you really care about. If you're passionate about the subject, I think it makes you a better shooter, you know, a better artist. Yeah.
I would say sort of one of the interesting facts that people don't always realize about ILCP is that, and I don't know the exact number, but I want to say it's 70 or 80% of our fellows who are really considered some of the top wildlife and nature photographers in the world come from a science background.
Yes.
They have biology degrees, their PhDs, their masters, even if it's just environmental science undergraduate, but they really come from a science background. So they understand what they're shooting. They get it. They understand the dynamics, the ecosystems, what's needed to conserve them and preserve them. And I think it is one of the things that makes them exceptional.
Absolutely.
Wildlife photographers.
Absolutely. Well, you know, and that's part of wildlife photography anyway, is that you have to understand the behavior of whatever it is you're shooting, or you're not going to get a shot that represents, you know, whatever that subject is.
Yeah. So when we get young people who ask me, what do I do, like, if I want to be this, you know, and I never tell them go study photography. I say go study science. Take a biology class.
And I agree a lot with that. And, you know, I'm a photographer, so I can say this. But of the skills to learn, having a degree in biology and really understanding a particular ecosystem. I was just talking with a photographer the other day who's a professor in Idaho, who his specialty is amphibians and reptiles. He's a very good photographer.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a lot easier to learn photography than it was to gather that knowledge that he has. And he's doing a very similar thing. He's using his work to educate people, to raise some money, to donate to the causes that he wants.
Yep.
Tell me a little bit about how you got involved with all this. Now, you've admitted to me that you're not a serious photographer.
I am not, yes. Well, again, it, you know, count the audience that you're with or the people you hang with.
Right.
I would never put my imagery up to any one of the folks that I work with.
I'm not sure I would either, though. You're working with some great people.
So, I wish I could say that it was a very well thought out plan, how I got here. It was more a very happy set of circumstances and coincidences. My background is really as a nonprofit manager. I was mostly in the world of international development before this, but I wanted to move towards conservation and environmental issues because I sort of saw how that was becoming the dominant factor even in international development. And women's rights and women's health and coincidences. I was brought on to help ILCP initially as a consultant, and eventually that turned into a gig. So I had a very big learning curve in terms of figuring out who all the photographers were, what their specialties were, the history, and I'm still learning. But it's been 4 years now, and it's been a really great ride.
So in a lot of ways, it's sort of the same thing for you, coming with a different set of skills, but the passion is, you share the passion with the photographers, but you're bringing different things to the table.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's in having an administrator in charge of the organization, it frees the fellows up to focus on the photography.
Absolutely.
And not run an organization, Absolutely. Which are not necessarily the same skill sets.
So. Oh, I know a lot of photographers. I can vouch for that. So, you know, what are you guys trying to do these days? I mean, you know, really, I mean, I'm sure you have a top level thing that you really want to accomplish, and then you have some other things. Let's start at the top. At the core, what do you want to accomplish?
You know, I think our mission statement says it all. It's furthering environmental and cultural conservation through ethical photography. And everything that we do is, I think we try very hard to really come back to that statement and how are we doing that, whether it is through supporting the community of professional photographers that are both fellows of the organization, but the broader community as well, because we only have 100 fellows. So it's a very small piece of the broader community. But anything we can do to support their work, which then translates into conservation efforts on their end, mentoring, talking about ethics with photographers, with conservation organizations, how ethical photography needs to be a part of the discussion, working with partners and facilitating their access to imagery and how they think about visual media in their campaigns. You know, we can speak about any one of those areas individually, but everything is driven by this mission of furthering ethical photography in the field of
conservation. Which is exactly what I want to talk about, because I hear ethical photography, I think I know what it means, but I think I need you to talk a little bit more about what it means to your organization.
Sure. So on our website, on our About Us page, it's right there front and center. We have an ethics statement about the practices that we expect our fellows to adhere to. And when new fellows are accepted into the organization, they have to sign off on the fact that they are going to follow these guidelines. A number of other organizations have used it as a basis for their own ethics statements. So I would urge your listeners to go and look at that. And we really try to address the three aspects, which is species, landscapes, and people. And there are different considerations, I think, in all three of those. In terms of the animals, of course, you know, you don't want to disrupt them. You don't want to interrupt a breeding pair or a mother hen taking care of her nestlings, of her chicks in the nest. What are acceptable practices in using lure or baiting? You know, these are all considerations that if someone is going to go out and shoot in the wild, needs to really think about. How much do you disrupt their natural behavior to get the image? And at some point, we really think photographers have to say, no image is worth what I need to do to get it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you have to step away from taking the image in the interest of protecting this animal that is of great interest to you. In landscapes, you know, of course, I mean, the simplest way to put it is leave no trace. Don't take equipment out that you're not willing to go back and get, particularly with camera trapping. You know, don't leave, if you're going to leave stuff out in the wild for 2 or 3 months to get the images, then you need to go back and get every single piece of equipment. Stay on trails where needed. It's tempting to get just a little bit closer to something that you want to catch, but if you're in a public park and there are restrictions on where you can go, there's a reason for those restrictions and they need to be adhered to and followed, oftentimes for the safety of both the photographer and the animals and species and landscapes that are there. And then with people, you know, obviously getting the right to shoot their images with indigenous communities in particular, this is super critical. There are some cultures where the image belongs to the person and even just taking their image is not appropriate. It takes their soul, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Not interfering with community traditions, respecting mother and children in their relationships and not getting in between that. So, but really respecting the culture, knowing it, studying it before you start shooting it and understanding what is appropriate
and what isn't. I think that's a good point. And I was thinking as you were talking, like for instance, animals generally speaking will let you know when you're too close or when you're interfering. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you've studied the animal at all, you understand their behavior. You can almost feel it the minute that you have crossed some sort of line. So the thing that I always ask photographers, the minute if you feel that, then take a step back, no matter what you're doing. And with indigenous communities, it's interesting. I think in a lot of ways, I think that's more complicated, you know, because there are different cultures and there are different ways of looking at it. But it seems like one thing that we can bring into it is common sense. Mm-hmm. You know, at some level, if you have your camera out and someone clearly is shying away from you as a result, that would tell me not to take the picture.
Right.
And not to force ourselves upon them.
But one has to recognize also that in some communities, for example, you know, depending what the objective is, but in some communities where women are not encouraged to speak up, they may even not feel comfortable saying anything to a male photographer. Oftentimes we'll find that the female photographers sort of are able to gain more access because the women feel much more comfortable with them. And
that's really interesting. Mm-hmm. I mean, that really is. When I used to shoot weddings, I always had my second shooter be a woman for that very reason.
Yeah.
Again, this is where you really have to understand the culture that you're immersed in.
You can't go in blind. You really have to do your homework, and particularly with people, have the trust of someone who can introduce you to a community. And again, you know, here we're talking the extreme example of indigenous communities that are really sort of within their own cultural norms. But I think it's true of any society. But, you know, to have someone who might introduce you. So when we work, for example, as an organization with conservation groups and we're going into communities, we always go in with a representative of that organization as the guide who's going to introduce the photographers to the community, explain to them what it is that they're doing. Yes, this is someone that you can trust, you know, not just have someone walk into a village and start taking pictures.
I think as we look at these three different areas, landscape, animals, and then indigenous communities, landscape, definitely common sense, right?
But even then, you know, what seems common sense when you have that sort of as part of an ethos or norm may seem much more obvious than in communities where maybe that isn't the practice. Mm. So when you have places like India or China, which have this new growing middle class that are buying cameras, that are going out and shooting stuff that don't necessarily have a history of an Ansel Adams to sort of look back. That's kind of part of a cultural ethos. There may not necessarily be that kind of immediate thought process about what is right and what is wrong. And sometimes, and it's not ill-intentioned, it's just a lack of sort of that foundational knowledge. And once we have a conversation, then it's like, oh, of course, that makes sense. But sometimes what may seem really obvious to some without kind of that light bulb moment doesn't really happen.
I think that's a good point. You know, and sometimes this happens in all sorts of areas, right? Not just conservation, where we think we know something. We behave according to that belief, only to discover later that maybe we didn't know quite as much about that as we should have. Mm-hmm.
Or we make assumptions about whether other people know. And
yes. So a good resource then is going online to the site, and we have information there waiting for them, and get up to speed, right?
Absolutely.
Good. Let's talk a little bit about photography and conservation and what photography can do for conservation these days, because, pun intended, the landscape has changed a little bit since Ansel Adams.
Absolutely.
Things seem to me to be a bit more complicated, but maybe not. How do you see the role these days of these photographers and then what's going on in the world of conservation? And what are a lot of them are trying to do? Are they trying to save land, species, protect indigenous communities, or is there more to it than that?
I think we could talk about this at different tiers. So if we look at, you know, particularly the ILCP fellows community, I would say that most of our photographers have specialties and things that they are really focused on. Again, it comes from having that science background oftentimes, whether it's a geology or anthropology or biology, and they tend to be driven by that. They are interested in entire ecosystems, but some will definitely approach it more from a people perspective, some more from a species perspective. They'll look at saving a habitat for the species. Some are looking more at the landscape as a whole. They're using their imagery, whether it's through exhibits or social media or articles in one of the magazines, be it National Geographic or Time or TNC, whatever, to try to get those stories out. And as we know, oftentimes, if you pick up a book and there's pictures in the middle, where do you go first?
Mm.
You go and look at the pictures.
Yes.
Right? And supposedly that sort of gives you an idea about what the whole book is going to be about. So this idea that images can help drive people, hopefully, to find out about something more in depth than just cursory knowledge, that visual impact is going to suck them in to learn about the issue, whether it is fracking or plastics pollution in the ocean or a rhino whose horn has been cut off, whatever it is, you know, that is going to make people stop, hopefully think, and if they see it enough times, eventually hopefully act on it and either influence their politicians, their legislators, start a community effort.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. So does your organization get political, or do you provide the fodder for other organizations that are already have the lobbies in place? How does that work?
Yeah, I mean, we do everything to support our partners and their efforts. Quite frankly, I mean, we deal with conservation groups on so many different topics. And I was actually talking to one group last night and I said, you know, I can't know every single legislator who's working on, you know, who's either for or against an issue, not only in the United States, but in Canada and Mexico and in Europe and whatever, because we deal with projects all over. So we don't really, as an organization, do that per se, but we will do everything we can to support our partners in their efforts to influence policymakers. And much of the media that we generate, particularly in terms of the video pieces, are call to actions for policy makers, community leaders, but we leave that distribution, the bulk of the distribution and the pushing out of those pieces to our partners to get it in front of the right eyes and the right people.
That to me seems like a great way to work. In all honesty, I would rather be at that end of the spectrum than hanging out in Washington, twisting arms.
Well, I do hang out in Washington, but I don't twist arms. I live in Washington for your listeners who might not have known that. So yes, but it is actually possible to live in Washington and have very little to do with politics. After 26 years of living there.
That's good to hear. So let's talk a little bit about a couple of the photographers. You know, Daniel Beltre is one that comes to mind for me. He's interesting character because he's part of Mindshift Gear, the genesis of it. And is he one of the founders?
One of the founding fellows of ILCP, wow. Yes. So okay. He was at that meeting in Anchorage that kind of got the whole thing started. And he is an amazing individual, an incredible photographer, of course, great aerials, really amazing artistic eye, I think. For me, some of his most powerful work is what he did after the spill in the Gulf. His aerial work, if you sort of stand 20 feet away, just looks like this beautiful kaleidoscope of oil, like an oil painting. It's gorgeous. And I'm thinking of one image in particular, and as you come closer, you kind of start realizing it's not an oil painting, but it's actually oil on water. And as you get closer, then you realize that this thing in the middle is a boat that's in the middle of this oil spill, that's in the middle of this water. And it's, I call them horrible beauty images, which are just artistically are just the most gorgeous images. But once you really sort of look into it and you realize what it is, you're like, oh my God, that's so awful.
And that's fascinating because when you're talking earlier about the rhino, you know, I have a hard time with images like that. I really do.
Yeah, a lot of people do.
I'm an animal lover for one thing, so it's very difficult for me. And the cruelty is another thing that really bothers me. So, but I also understand, you know, different cultures have different ways of looking at things. So when I see that image from a distance, then sometimes I have a hard time walking closer. What's interesting about Danielle's work then is that he will actually pull you into the message.
Yeah, no, he is. He has an amazing eye.
I would think that this is the kind of photographer that this organization attracts.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
They're my favorites.
I'm liking your job more and more.
Yeah, it's not that, I have to say.
Hey, let's talk a little bit about WildSpeak.
Sure.
Because, you know, we've been talking about online and reading stuff and so forth, but you actually have a conference, right?
We do. So we've held the conference twice internationally in 2009 in Mérida, Mexico, actually at the 9th World Wilderness Conference. So 4 years at the same event as we were founded at. Then again in 2013 in Salamanca. And at the 10th World Wilderness Conference, and they were incredibly successful events, and we were looking for something that we could sort of be more regular and systematic about the efforts. So last year, we launched WildSpeak in Washington, D.C., and it is now an annual event, so it will be November 15 and 16 in D.C. again this year, and it's 2 days. It's a symposium. We really look at it as a working conference almost, not just sort of a regular photo festival, because we go much deeper than looking just at how the images were made. We really talk about impact to visual media in conservation, the meaning behind the messages. Once you've acquired that skill and you've become a good photographer, what can you do with that image that might go beyond having it on the wall.
So is this something that I could attend?
Oh, absolutely. It's open to the public. We expect the probably about half of the audience consists of folks from conservation groups that are really there to learn maybe new techniques, think about new ways that they might communicate their messaging and their campaigns. And the other half, and within that community, I include scientists and funders and the actual program and communications folks from the conservation groups. And then I would say approximately the other half are photo clubs, photo aficionados, people who are there to kind of listen to their idols. This year, Steve Winter will be one of our keynote speakers, which is a big draw, I think, for many people. Our MC will be John Bauermeister, who's done quite a bit of work in film, mostly. He's known for his film work, but also in environmental advocacy work, most recently with his Dear Mr. Obama films. And so we're working on the lineup. It's going to be really exciting, but we offer lots of opportunities for folks to network, speak to the photographers, make connections. We know of a bunch of really great stuff that happened after the fact last year, and we're really excited to make that happen again.
So now I'm thinking, now this is the way I can get another trip into Washington, yes, D.C. and see a really good and participate in a really good conference at the same time.
I don't think you would regret it. The feedback we got last year was just phenomenal, and from people across the spectrum of the audience. And literally the only negative comment that we got more than once was that it wasn't long enough. So last year was one day and we decided to go to 2 days this year just to kind of really hopefully give people an overload.
And you have some videos on the site, so people can see some of the speakers from last year.
Yep, we have all of our individual presenters from last year are on our site. If they go to the WildSpeak page, there's a sub-tab there that says videos from WildSpeak 2015, and it'll kind of give people a sense of the presentation. So we have individual presentations that are 20 minutes long, and then some keynotes and some panel discussions where we'll bring in not just photographers, but practitioners or editors and talk about different things. Ethics will be one of our panels this year, probably one on photojournalism and sort of how do you get the story right off the bat in photography and how do photographers work with writers potentially to get stories out there. We'll be doing some highlights on some ILCP projects.
This sounds really good. This has been great, by the way. I'm really enjoying this. So where do we go from here? So, you know, we have, you know, the photographers in this audience, I'll be honest with you, they're really good photographers.
Mm-hmm, I'm sure. Far better than me, I'm sure.
Well, I don't know. I haven't seen your work yet. You know, a lot of photographers talk down their stuff. The smart ones talk down their stuff, right? But, you know, what message do we want to leave with them, you know, at the end of this conversation? Because a lot of them are outside. A lot of them love travel. A lot of them are, you know, going to places.
Yeah, I would say, you know, really educate yourself about where you're going, what you're going to be shooting. Follow the practices of a group like ours, and there are others out there. NAMPA also has a code of ethics that they have on their site. You know, really look at those and inform yourself. Put your stuff out there on social media for an appropriate cause. I mean, we don't think that every photographer should take on every cause, but if you take one thing that you care about, and even better if it's in your backyard and not across the world, because it's hard to stay engaged in things unless you have you're a trust fund child and you have unlimited travel budget. But we really encourage people to use their photography in support of some messaging that is important to them and that they're going to care about and hopefully follow up on. We had this site that I mentioned earlier, which is a great sort of citizen advocacy example. It's run by one of our associate fellows, Ladio Fernandez, who is in the Dominican Republic. The name of the website is Eco and the Medio Ambiente. So it's Spanish, and we can perhaps put it on the blog, but so Eco and the environment, and it lives on Facebook, and it's a site that encourages Dominicans with their cell phones or their cameras or whatever to upload pictures to the site of things that they see happening in violation, perhaps of environmental regulations, dumping. I know I heard one story where someone reported a wildfire that was in one of the national forests that no one was aware of, and they were able to catch it in time because it had been reported. People are seeing the site, folks at the Ministry of the Environment, and they're responding and reacting. So it's a great, you know, that's just one example of how people, you know, they may feel like, what can I do with my imagery? But that's something that people can really sort of push stuff forward and maybe have the image have a little bit more meaning than just being a great picture.
Well, I think so. I mean, I think that's really a good thing to put out there, because I think a lot of folks, even myself included sometimes, you know, I love capturing a picture, or a picture has meaning to me, not thinking that if I get it out there, maybe use some, do you guys use hashtags and so forth?
Is we there, do.
Yeah.
And we really encourage that. And, uh-huh. You know, I mean, there's no right solution for everybody. So sure. There's a lot of platforms, and I would encourage anyone to find the one that most suits them. Mm-hmm. Some of us are less adept at hashtagging than others.
right.
But I think there's a lot of platforms out there, a lot of ways. And if it's working with your local rangers at your, you know, the park that exists half a mile away from your house, and working with them on their education programs with kids. I mean, there's so many different ways that people can take this hobby that they're crazy about and maybe give it a different angle. We want to sustain professional photographers and don't want to undermine their work. And we tell the professional photographers, you know, choose 3 or 5 organizations that instead of writing a check to, you will support with your imagery, because it's an asset that you can bring to the table that no one else can. And we really encourage the conservation groups to treat photography as a donation as they would anything else, and that they need to nurture the photographers as donors, just like they would someone who's going to write a check for them. But I think that anyone who sort of is truly driven by photography, it can do this and, you know, become involved with the group, not simply by giving your images, but by really becoming involved with them, help them with their communications plan, you know, treat that as your donation, which has huge value, because a lot of groups don't have the visual imagery that they need to be able to communicate whatever messages that they're trying to get across to their stakeholders.
I love that. That's really good. That's really a great place to hang out here. All right, you got me all ready to go now.
Good. That's what we
like. So, all right, how can people find out more about this? What's the website? Let's take care of a little bit of that.
All right, so we have a few options. If you want to go directly to the WildSpeak page to learn about WildSpeak, it's wildspeak.org. We have conservationphotographers.org and ilcp.ngo, which tends to work easier for the international community. So a couple of options there. Everything will eventually get you to our site, and we encourage your listeners to go to read up on the ethics, but also all of the fellows are listed on there and their bios, and you can look them up by country, and maybe you can find, for your international audience, photographers that are closer to home and follow their work, lots of North American photographers, and learn about their specialties. You might find some inspiration in their work and in their own efforts.
Thank you, Alex.
My pleasure.
All right.
Thank you so much. Really enjoyed it.
Wasn't that terrific? Boy, did I enjoy meeting with her. And I'm thinking of going to Washington, D.C. in November and covering that event. So there may be more about this up the road. But for now, I think we got plenty to think about and a few things to go explore over at their site. In the news, the top 10 DSLRs and lenses Canon is loaning out at the Rio Olympics, and this is via Petapixel. And so here's how the loans went the first week of the Olympics. It's a top 10 list. I thought you might get a kick out of it. You can probably guess some of these. Some might be surprises, but here are the top 10 loans that Canon made to their professional photographers during the Rio Olympics. Number one, the EOS 1D X Mark II, that was loaned 285 times. Next, the EF 200 to 400 millimeter F4L IS USM extender 1.4. So this is that wonderful lens that I always thought I wanted, but I don't really have any real use for it to justify it. But I always just wanted it anyway. It's the 200 to 400 millimeter F4, and then it has the built-in 1.4x extender. That was loaned out 231 times, and if I would have been there, it would have been 232. Next up, the EF 70-200 F2.8L IS2 USM zoom lens. This is a lens that every photographer needs, I think, if they're shooting Canon. That was loaned out 211 times. Next up, the EF 400 millimeter F2.8L, 131 times. The EF 24-70 F2.8L2, loaned 130 times. The EF 600 millimeter F4L IS2, loaned 126 times. So who's shooting with that 600 millimeter? I mean, what are they covering? That is, oh, well, okay. Nice and tight, right? Next up, the EOS 1DX, loaned 123 times. Then the EF 8-15 millimeter F4L fisheye, loaned 105 times. That's a really good choice. I mean, if you really want to shake up your work, you know, getting that 8-15 F4 fisheye, nice call, guys. You 105 guys, yeah, I'm with you there. That'd probably been 106 if I'd been there, right? The EF 16-35 F2.8L, that was loaned 84 times. And then rounding out the top 10, the EOS 1DX Mark II VIP and EF 300 millimeter F2.L IS USM. That was loaned out 77 times. I have a feeling you needed special credentials for that one. Anyway, so there's the top 10 Canon loanouts at the first week of the Rio Olympics. Anyway, I thought it was interesting. I hope you found it that way too. The Hedge free license. So I haven't talked about Hedge for Mac for a bit, but I want to share this information with you today about the free license. And well, here, let me read you the blurb here. This will explain it all. Not sure if Hedge will improve your workflow speed drastically? Go to hedgeformac.com, all one word, hedgeformac.com/TDS, download the app, and you'll receive a free 10-day pass to give it a thorough test run. If you like, there's a link to the 20% discount for you there too. So this gives you 10 days to explore all the features of the best version of Hedge and really get to know it. Now, what is Hedge again? Did you forget already? It's only been a few weeks since I talked about it. It's the fastest app for importing and backing up media on Mac OS. You can import multiple sources to multiple destinations at the same time. Boy, I bet the Olympic guys would love to have that right now. Wouldn't Hedge be awesome in the media center at the Olympics when these guys are coming in with all these cards and all this stuff and they got to get it downloaded and sorted? Oh my gosh, Hedge should be on every one of those Macs in the main press center, I'll tell you. All right, maybe next time, huh? Maybe in Tokyo. And then also, every file copied by Hedge is cross-verified with the original. That way you know that that file is good, okay? So there's a free version and a premium version, but just go and do the test run and you can use the premium version for 10 days. It's hedgeformac.com/TDS. And if you like what you see, you can save 20% off the pro version right there on the site. You just got to go to our page and you'll automatically get the discount. All right, one other thing. I want to talk about Red River Paper because I'm working on something that involves them. I am working on an article that those of you that are using Capture One Pro or thinking about using Capture One Pro might be interested in, because the article that I'm working on is how to create fine art greeting cards with Capture One Pro, your inkjet printer, and of course that great cardstock from Red River Paper. And the reason why I think this is important, because what I'm doing is trying to show you the easiest way to create these beautiful fine art greeting cards. You can sell them at the local coffee shop. You can use them for very memorable gifts. People love them. I've mentioned many times people have framed some of the cards that I gave them, which is just so cool when you go over to their house and you see your fine art card framed and hanging in the, you know, over by their desk or something. Ah, just love it. Anyway, so stay tuned, and as soon as I get this article exactly the way that I want, I'll let you know. I'll publish it. And those of you that are using Capture One Pro or thinking about Capture One Pro, you'll have yet another reason to embrace that wonderful application, using it with my favorite inkjet paper company, Red River Paper. And don't forget about their Facebook page. I have a great Facebook page at facebook.com/redriverpaper. All right, that's going to do it for me this week. That was quite a bit of stuff, wasn't it? I hope you enjoyed it. I know I did. I'm working on some more great stuff for next week. Please come back and join me. Thanks to all the new members who signed up for Patreon and are part of our inner circle. If you're interested in becoming a supporter of this site, of this podcast, and being a member of the inner circle, go to patreon.com/thedigitalstory. See you next week. Bye-bye now.